everybody, Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy, which airs every Friday night here at 7:30. And this is a special show. We don't do this too often, but it's time for another one of our interviews. It's time for an interview with Terry Jones, he of Monty Python and many other things, most of which we will discuss. In addition to Monty Python, Terry Jones wrote, along with Michael Palin, the Ripping Yarns series, which is quite special, quite marvelous in its own way. And he has written three children's books, one entitled Fairy Tales, one called The Saga of Eric the Viking, and a new one called Nickabobinus. And what else has he done? He has directed a movie which is due to come out any day now called Personal Services. He wrote the screenplay for Labyrinth, which is something we don't discuss here. And he was the director on the Monty Python movies. And all sorts of things. And so he's got quite a lot to talk about, and let's get to it. Here's Terry Jones. At what point, if any, in the history of Monty Python, did you realize that you were really onto something legendary, something that would be to television what the Goon Show was to radio?
Well, I never thought it would be as good as the Goon Show, because I sort of grew up with the Goon Show and thought, and this was, you know, sort of nothing could be more mind-blowingly, sort of mind-opening and expanding than the Goon Show. However, I mean, I always thought, I always just assumed, when we all got together, the six of us, I knew that John and Graham and Mike and myself and Eric, between us, we were writing the funniest stuff around. So it always seemed to me that we had a very strong chance that it was going to be, we were going to make the best show on television. I never had any doubt about that, actually. And the only sort of anxiety and the only question before we started doing it was trying to find some sort of format for it that gave it something unique. English television companies have a very enlightened policy of wiping shows because they can't possibly keep them all. Mm-hmm. Well, they thought they couldn't, so they wiped. In fact, they were going to wipe the Python shows. And Your Country saved us, in fact, because that Ron DeVilliers saved us, who ran the public television station in Dallas. And what happened was that he... Despite the BBC, he started looking at some of these shows, and he spent a weekend and looked at all these shows. This was in about 1974, I suppose it was, and thought, I must have these shows. And he rang the BBC and said, have you got any more of them? And they said, no, you can't be interested. They're not really very good. And he said, come on, look. I want to buy them. And he actually got the things on television in Dallas, and then it kind of spread from there. And once... there was a market in America for the shows, then the BBC thought twice about wiping them, but they actually were going to wipe them.
It's funny, because we run a lot of BBC radio, and we get the same reaction all the time. There are things that we want to run, and they say, you couldn't possibly be interested in it. You know? Very funny attitude for them.
Well, this is BBC, they call this BBC Enterprises, and they have an office in New York, and we hear, I mean, people, when we would... trying to get Python into the States, you know, people would ring up and say, can we see the Python shows? And BBC Enterprises would generally react in that kind of way. Well, are you sure? You don't really. I mean, it's not quite what you think.
And now they're putting out the episodes on video cassette?
Yeah, well, that's not BBC, actually. That's what happened...
CBS Fox or something?
Yes. In fact, actually, we now own the copyrights to the shows because the BBC... sold the last series we did without John. They sold them to ABC Television, and ABC put them out
with disastrous results.
Yes, absolutely. They just cut them to bits and edited them and destroyed the shows. And we were sort of livid and tried to stop them, but told we couldn't. And Mike Palin and Terry Gilliam came up to New York, and there was a court case, and they sort of. They tried to stop the second show going out, and they said, you can't, and so they put out the second show. And then, a bit later, one of our lawyers suddenly discovered something which I should have remembered, because I can remember insisting on it originally, putting it into the original contracts, which was to put in a clause saying that they couldn't re-edit the shows once they'd been transmitted. And this had been sort of put into the original contracts, and then everybody had forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. And suddenly... our New York lawyer suddenly found this in the small print, and so both BBC and Time Live and ABC were all in sort of breach of the original contract, and as a settlement, they had to give us, they gave us all the rights to the shows.
Oh, so it has a happy ending after
it
all.
It does indeed. I'm very happy.
Despite the those two airings on ABC, it's be worth putting up with those in order to get the copyrights back.
I mean, it was unbelievable, these airings. I mean, you couldn't believe what they'd done to the show. They'd fallen into the typical trap of people who are thinking they're editing things for censorship, that they're going to censor things. And they'd ended up by cutting out totally innocuous things, and there was no sketch left. I mean, there was one sketch in which I come into a doctor's surgery and I'm bleeding and just blood is pumping out of me and you can just see the blood pumping out and the doctor says, well, take a seat and could you mind filling in this form first of all and what's your insurance situation and all this kind of thing. And blood's falling on the carpet and I'm trying to mop the carpet up and everything. And that's the sort of premise of the scene. And there was a little introduction to the scene where the doctor was writing something, which didn't quite work, but we hadn't been able to cut out the little introduction bit because of, for technical reasons. And when we saw it in the ABC version, they'd left this little bit that didn't quite work at the beginning, and they'd cut the scene because there was too much blood in it. So, amazing. You know, it's all right to have, you know, the A-team killing people and people hacking each other to death in the cause of law and order, but not to have
not in the name of comedy.
Not in the name of comedy. No.
Well, when you were originally doing those shows, you had quite a bit of creative freedom.
Yeah, very much so.
Do you think that that kind of creative freedom can exist again, either in the UK or here?
Well, I think it can. I don't think it does. Certainly, the climate's changed enormously in England. The political climate and the climate of freedom of expression has changed. We noticed it when we were making Python that the whole thing changed. It was partly because the nature of the BBC changed at the same time, and the BBC became more and more censorious and more jumpy as time went on. It wasn't just because of us, it was because of other elements, really. When we first made the series in 1969, the BBC was a truly anarchic organisation. Although it had this very sort of impressive sort of upper-class image, it was actually an anarchic organisation in the true sense of the word, in that the organisation came from below and it wasn't imposed from above. And the producers were the top dogs and they carried the can for every production. The result was that the heads of departments and the programme directors never read scripts, they never saw the programmes before they went out. They only saw things when they went out. And then the producers all carried the can for whatever went out. However, by the second series, this had all began to change, and they started wanting to see the shows once we made them. They started wanting to see the shows before we put them out. And then, by the third series, they wanted to read the scripts before we actually even made the shows. And so sort of censorship within the BBC was creeping in. And it was very much a result of the kind of political pressures that had been put on the BBC from the Wilson government onwards.
Do you feel responsible for that? Do you think that it was because of some of the things that you were doing that they felt, wait, maybe we better take a look at these things before?
Well, I suppose you could say there was a sketch that we did in the last show of the first series, which was a sketch in which John walks into an undertaker's office and says he wants to bury his mother, and he says he's got her in a sack here. And the undertaker says, you've got her in a sack? He says, well, how do you want to get rid of her? Do you want to burn her, bury her, or dump her? And John says, well, which do you suggest? And eventually the undertaker says, well, we could eat her. And John is absolutely outraged by this suggestion. And the undertaker says, well, you know, I mean, I'll tell you what, he says, we could eat her, and then if you feel a bit guilty about it, we could dig a hole and you could throw up into it. And I mean, I remember when I heard this, when John read the sketch out to us around my dining room table one day, I remember being sort of a bit shocked by this and thinking, we can't do that. And then I went off and made the coffee and thought, well, why can't we do it? I mean, it's not saying that you should eat your mother when she's dead, it's just sort of playing around with the idea of somebody who is sort of so actually who changes his mind. It's the hypocrisy of the man who walks in.
It's a very funny sketch.
But on the other hand, I wouldn't think the BBC would say, oh, well, they'd point to something like that and say, that's why we had to start clamping down, because it did create quite an outcry within the BBC. And at the same time, it was Harold Wilson was the president, was the prime minister at the time, and he put into the BBC as chairman of the Board of Governors a very politically motivated man by the name of Lord Hill. And that from that moment on, political interference and pressure was much greater on the BBC than it had been before.
Is Python still under contract to Universal? And does the recent dispute over Terry Gilliam's Brazil affect that relationship?
No, we're not under contract to Universal. We just had a contract purely for The Meaning of Life with Universal. Very good contract, by the way. I mean, they were really nice to us. And I think it's very naughty of Terry Gilliam to go and bite their hand, you know, and queer the pitch for all the rest of us. I don't know whether Terry's fight with Universal would affect their attitudes to me. I mean, I don't know, said Scheinberg, so I don't know whether he would carry a grudge against one of my friends over to me.
No, but I mean, if Python were to make another film.
But Terry wasn't, you know, Brazil wasn't a Python film, so I mean, why should it affect Python, really?
Well, how do you feel when you see various projects by individual members advertised as Monty Python's Jabberwocky or Monty Python's John Cleese in Clockwise? Or
yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's perfectly all right to see Monty Python's John Cleese in Clockwise, but I think it's very naughty when you see Monty Python's Jabberwocky. Mm-hmm. Because it's doing a disservice both to Python and to Jabberwocky. I mean, Jabberwocky was a very different film from Python. Mm-hmm. And to advertise it as Python sort of gave people a different expectation when they went into the cinema, and an expectation in which they'd be disappointed. Whereas if they went in and saw it for what it was a terrific film. But I think it's a bit of sharp practice, that, which I don't like.
You're in one of the ripping yarns, right? You were in the first one.
The very first one, yeah.
That's my favourite one, in fact.
It really is.
I love that one.
It's nice, really. I'd like to have been all the ripping yarns, but the BBC weren't very keen on me being in them, so I got edged out.
Those are now also available on video cassette here. How are they doing? Do you know?
I don't know. Not sure at all. I'm very fond of the ripping yarns. I think, what I like about them is that it was after the first time that Mike and I actually managed to tell stories. I mean, we'd written one of the Pythons that was a story. I mean, the thing called the cycling tour. Mm-hmm. And that actually hadn't started off as a Python show. That had really started off as Mike and me writing something to do ourselves. And it just happened in the third series of Python. We were running out of material. And so Mike and I said, well, we do have this show that we could sacrifice. And it was great, because really then we got the input from John and Graham and Eric and Terry. And the whole second half of the show became really out of their writing. So although the first half was what we'd written originally,
that's a wonderful episode. And in that one, there's who's the female singer that they keep making reference to?
Clodagh Rodgers.
Now, I guarantee you that you know, less than 1% of the United States of America has ever heard of Clodagh Rodgers or whatever that song that she keeps singing in that episode.
I'm just checking the box. But it won the Eurovision Song Contest. You've seen that, yeah.
Well, very few Eurovision Song Contest songs are ever heard of in the United States.
Again, or in England, yes.
But yet, even not knowing who she is, that gets funnier and funnier every time it comes on. I think I once did hear that song long after I had seen that Python sketch, and I just laughed all the way through it. I was with some people that said, "What's so funny about this song?" And
I think it killed the song, boy.
I think a mercy killing, probably. I've read that it is solely due to your enthusiasm that Python ever reunites. After a long hiatus, there was this reunion to make The Meaning of Life. How tough was it to reestablish that collaboration?
Well, I didn't enjoy it, I must say. I found the writing of Meaning of Life very very tedious. It sort of stretched over into a long period, because we'd get together for a week or something and then separate for several months and then get together again. And it was... we kept on going over the same material, and I found it a bit tedious, really. It was getting difficult then, because people had got their own projects and... you know, there wasn't all the enthusiasm coming from everybody that maybe there should have been. And yet we'd agreed that we'd do a film together. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't decide what the film was going to be. And we kept on coming up with this material, which we all made us laugh and we thought was funny. And yet we still couldn't agree what the actual shape of the film was going to be.
Is the book closed on Monty Python?
I can't see us doing anything together. We're getting together. I mean, actually, we're seeing quite a lot of each other at the moment, because we're in the process of setting up a production company, which will be kind of an in-house company to centralise all our own individual products. So, like a film that I'm over here to sort of raise finance for at the moment, the film John's over here to raise finance for, and Terry Gilliam's been trying to raise finance for his film. We'll do all those three films under the same umbrella title of our production company. And that gives us a kind of freedom to actually work together and cooperate and read each other's scripts and criticise in the way we always have done, and get each other's opinions of what we're doing without actually committing ourselves to actually the straitjacket of Python. Because in the end, I think I've found a great release in getting away from Python, in that Python was always very concerned about the joke and the moment and the concentration of material and the concentration of humour, and never about the overall structure or the overall view of the film. Mm-hmm. And consequently, it's a very difficult thing to sustain, and also it's not very interested in narrative, and it's always been a struggle to try and get narrative into Python. And I like narrative a lot, and mm-hmm. I find it kind of freeing to get away from the pressure of Python.
But were you worried that Python would be a tough act to follow? And that everything that you ever did afterward would be compared, and that you would always be Monty Python's Terry Jones?
Well, I don't mind always being Monty Python's Terry Jones. It's not really... I mean, I haven't really thought about having that on my tombstone, but it's never been a terribly bad thing to me, because I've been quite lucky in going off in different directions. Like, I think the first thing I did after the Holy Grail was I wrote an academic book about Chaucer. So, in fact, actually, it was quite nice writing that and playing against the Python image. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've sort of written two or three children's books. And again, it's quite nice writing children's books that are sort of... they're what they are in their own right. And occasionally you get somebody saying, well, it's very Python-esque humour, which is nonsense, really. I mean,
no, they're not at all. They're lovely. They really are lovely.
But, I mean, it's not... I mean, what do they mean when they say it's Python-esque? I mean, there's a few jokes and occasionally, or a few funny bits, but I mean, yeah. I wouldn't say... I don't know what Python-esque is, anyway, is it?
So you think that that the book is then probably closed on Python?
Yes, I think it's unlikely that we'd...
I'd like to see another television series. Do you miss coming up doing those short little bursts?
No,
that
I don't really. No, I think that's a great release, is not to have to do those, really. I mean,
I would think it's the difference between writing a song and writing a symphony.
Yeah. It's not quite like that. I'd say it's more like... I mean, like this film I've just written now... I suddenly stopped trying to think about writing a film as if it was writing a novel and thinking about this bigger undertaking. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly thought, actually, what I really think is you can't make films out of novels, and that films really are short stories. Oh, and yeah. So I really just thought about the fairy tales I'd written, my children's stories, and I approached the film from that point of view and just with that kind of feeling. And I suddenly found it wrote itself very easily.
Do you enjoy watching comedy? Or do you find yourself looking at it with too professional an eye?
Well, if the comedy's working. I mean, if I watch a Woody Allen film, I mean, my professional eye is just saying, bloody hell, how can he do it? I mean, I suppose occasionally, I mean, I don't look at an awful lot of television or film, to tell the truth. I spend most of my time sort of having a nice time eating and drinking and things like that, really.
Very sensible attitude, I must say. Tell us about the children's books. How did they come to be? I love them. I think they're wonderful.
It happened really because my daughter, Sally, was five. And I thought, it'd be nice to read her some fairy tales. I always liked the idea of fairy tales. I've always liked the idea. It'd be nice to try and write some. But I thought it was a bit daunting, really. Try and come up with kind of images like in the best fairy tales or in some of the Aesop's fables, things like that, or some of the Greek myths. It'd be nice to come up with ideas like that that are simple. But then I started reading some to my daughter, and I found them a bit long-winded, to tell the truth. And also, occasionally, I felt, well, I'm not sure I really go along with this morality of some of them. Mm-hmm. And so I think one Monday morning I sort of got to my desk, and I suddenly thought, well, actually, there isn't anything I have to do. I've actually done all my posts. I don't have to do it. There's nothing I actually have to do. And I suddenly thought, I could actually write a fairy tale. So I wrote a fairy tale called The Beast with a Thousand Teeth. by lunchtime, and I thought, oh, that was easy. So I thought, well, I'll write another one. So I wrote another one. So I'd finished two by the end of the day, and when she was going to bed, I read her the two stories, and she seemed to like them, which was no surprise, really, because I'd just written them for her, really. I hadn't thought about writing the greatest story in the world. Mm-hmm. I just thought, I'd just write what I know Sally likes, and I'll just shamelessly put in monsters and things that I know will get Sally going. And that was a kind of big release, because, you know, it's terribly inhibiting if you sit down and try and write the best film in the world, or the funniest, or the best story in the world. But just to write something which you know will amuse a small five-year-old with is a different thing. And she responded to them, and so I felt encouraged by this. I had a pat on my back for my five-year-old daughter. And so for the rest of that week, I managed to write about two stories a day, I suppose. So by the end of the week, I'd got about sort of a dozen or more stories. And I suddenly thought, maybe I can make a book out of this. And so it happened. Strike rate went down after that. It turned about one a day, then it went one every 2 days, and then it got a bit
Well, they're wonderful stories. Is that all there is, the two books, or will you be doing some more of that?
There's a third book, which is called Knickerbobbinus, which has been published by Peter Bedrick Books in New York. So it's more of a story, really. It's more like a novel, really. But it's about a story of a boy who could do anything. At least it isn't really, but that's what it sets out to say it is.
Well, I'll have to pick it up. I look forward to it. I understand you have a new movie coming out. John Cleese told us a little bit about it.
Oh yes, Personal Services.
Yes.
Yes, that's not something I've written. It's the first time I've actually directed something that I haven't written, and it's. It's a jolly good film, actually. quite good. It's based on, or it's inspired by, the life of a lady who ran a brothel in South London, in a very respectable area of South London. And for about 20 years, she ran this brothel. Nobody knew, none of the neighbours knew. I think Carl Davis, the film composer, was was her next door neighbour for quite a few years. He never knew there was a brothel next door. And the police never knew until somebody tipped them off. And they raided her in about 1980. And she put her up for trial. And she was sent down for about 6 months. But in fact, she became a hero. She became a popular hero in England. The film is sort of inspired by that. It stars Julie Walters and Alec McCowan, who's a CBE, Commander of the British Empire, and probably won't get his knighthood now after doing this film. But one of the interesting things about the film is that art imitates life, and then how life imitates art. Because we were filming the last scene in the raid in the film, when the police raided the original lady. We were filming the last scene, and at the same time, in fact, Cynthia Payne, who was the lady who ran the brothel in Streatham, was actually holding an end-of-film party for some of her old friends and people.
Does she appear in the film?
No. She's played by Julie Walters. And the thing is, it's not her life story. It's a fiction based on, comes out of her life. But anyway, she was having a sex party for various people when we were having this...
She's still in business then?
No, she's not in business, but she did throw sex parties every so often because... I mean, not to make money, but to... because it's what she enjoyed doing.
Just to keep her hand in, right?
Yeah, it was her life. It was the only way she saw her old friends. And a lot of her clients were her friends. So they'd been clients for 20 years. They were elderly men, mostly. And they were her friends. The police actually... We were doing shooting the last shot of the police raid in the film. And Cynthia was having one of her sex parties. And the police raided her again for real. I have to tell you, we could only afford about 20 policemen, and there's about 30 or 40 policemen actually raided her. They could afford more than we could. Why? I don't know.
Just to keep their hand in, probably. Everybody does what they do.
Well, maybe that's right. You may be absolutely right. But it's certainly become a cause célèbre now in England. We've had to hold the film off it was finished, it was ready for the London Film Festival in November, but we had to hold it off because Cynthia's case was coming up in court, and so we couldn't put it out before the court case. And in fact, it's just finished now. When I'm speaking, this middle of February, she was acquitted, in fact. And the British press has just been... It's just inundated the British press at the moment, and the television. You can't turn the television on or pick up a newspaper without reading about Madam Sin, as she's called. One of the nice things about life imitating art, though, was that the only time that Cynthia came to the filming, or almost the only time she came to see the filming, was when we were filming the main part of the police raid. And we'd written into the film a little bit in which Christine, the lady in the film, played by Julie Walters, when she's being shown, when she's arrested, she refuses to go in the van with the other girls and insists on travelling in the police chief's car. And evidently, when Cynthia Payne had seen this, and when the police actually raided her and they were hustling her out in the street, she said, "I'm not going in the van. Julie Walters didn't go in the van." She insisted on going in the car with the police chief. And they let her.
That's wonderful.
But it's, I mean, it's, the creepy thing is that I don't know what the police are playing at, really, because there'd been two. I'd been to two of the parties beforehand, because David Leland, who'd written the thing, said I ought to come and have a look and see what the atmosphere of the parties was like. And so we went along.
Yeah, it was strictly professional. Right?
It was. And evidently, there'd been two plainclothes policemen, one dressed as a woman, at these parties. They'd infiltrated the parties, and they were sort of. And when one of these policeman gave evidence at the party, he sort of said in court that he'd been there and he'd seen Terry Jones talking to Cynthia Payne at one stage. So next morning the press, the Sun, or the Scum as we call it, had its big front page. A whole front page was taken up with a photograph of me looking seedy and a big headline saying TV Python comic at sex orgies. It's like you couldn't make up a headline.
Do you have that framed at home now?
I have, actually. Michael Palin gave it me for my birthday.
Somehow. That's wonderful.
And so is Terry Jones wonderful. If you just joined us, you've been listening to an interview with Terry Jones, he of Monty Python. And also, we should mention, as we did in the interview, that Terry is the director of a film that's just about to come out called Personal Services. I have not yet seen it, but I have it on many reliable opinions that it is terrific. I can speak from first-hand knowledge and tell you that his children's books are wonderful. If you have any children or know any children, or if you are a child, as are we all, you should pick up these books. One is called Fairy Tales, one is called The Saga of Eric the Viking, and the new one is called Nicobobinus. He's also the Monty Python you know all about, you should know all about. He also was involved in Ripping Yarns. He wrote them with Michael Palin, and they are rentable and very delightful in their own way. And he also wrote the screenplay to Labyrinth. Anyway, you get the idea. Terry Jones, let's hear it for him. Wonderful fellow. Special thanks go out to Jonathan Dana and Ula Annabelle for helping get that whole thing together. Oh, and also to John Goldstone. And so, let's see, next week we'll be doing comedy of and about the 60s. And so until then, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you, as ever, to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.